Good morning, Maine. You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLLB, 13:10 a.m. What a special show we have today.
Yeah.
It is Valentine's Day, which in itself is special.
Happy Valentine's Day, Steve-o.
Same thing to you, Deb, and Shani McShani. Happy Valentine's Day to both of you. Mm. We've got a fascinating, entertaining, interesting, compelling show today.
Yes.
No hyperbole at all.
No.
In just about 3 minutes, we'll get to an interview I did yesterday with international best-selling author Tess Gerritsen, who lives here in Maine for, I think, almost 24, 25 years.
Yes.
She is known to most people as the author of Rizzoli and Isles, which is a very popular novel series,
mm-hmm.
crime medical examiner series, very interesting. And it's also a hit show on TNT, which they start up in the next couple of weeks.
Yes, they do.
Fascinating interview. And then later on in the second hour, we have Lloyd Erland, who is a PhD forest economist and president of the Erland Group, talking about what's going on with Maine's forestry, both from a kind of tourism standpoint as well as the economy. But before we get to those two interviews, let's do a quick on this day, February 14th. Probably the first thing that jumps out at me is in 1989, which really wasn't that long ago.
Hmm.
I mean, we're looking at 25, 26 years ago.
Right.
The first satellite of 24 that make up the GPS system, you know, how GPS works,
yes.
Global positioning.
Yes.
There's 24 of them, apparently, and they're all orbiting the Earth, and they're set up so at least four or five are within range from anywhere on the planet.
Hmm.
And that's how they're able to measure and give directions, because they triangulate. So if you're at a certain point and you get a signal from one, two, or three, it knows exactly where you're at based on the signal going back and forth. And originally, the system was designed for the Defense Department. And then in 1993, it was available to everyone on Earth.
There you go.
Second thing, let's go right into birthdays. Rob Thomas, who's one of my favorite musicians, he turns 43 today.
It's good stuff.
Are you dancing in there?
Of course.
Huh.
That's what you call it, yeah.
That's what you call it? You're kind of shuffling back and forth. You're doing something. Anyhow, that's his birthday. So on this day, February 14th, happy Valentine's Day. Oh, by the way, you know, according to the Greeting Card Association, guess how many Valentine's Day cards are sent every year?
Oh, I don't know.
1 billion.
1 billion?
And it's the second largest card sending holiday of the year, which for Christmas is 2.6 billion.
Wow.
And you know what percentage women purchase of all Valentine's?
Half?
85%.
85%?
That's coming from the Greeting Card Association, and those folks are always telling
so
the truth.
So what, do some women buy themselves their own Valentine's card or something? Or?
We could do a whole show on that, but it won't be today.
Okay.
So why don't we go into the interview? And again, this was an interview I did yesterday with Tess Gerritsen. Fascinating lady, incredibly talented, incredibly warm. And really enjoyed the interview. So let's get into that. Here is Tess Gerritsen, international best-selling author of Rizzoli and Isles and many, many other novels. Here it is. Welcome back to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLB, 13:10 a.m. Many of you may recognize that intro music as being from the Rizzoli and Isles series, which is on TNT, and I think their new season starts the next week or so. But we are so pleased and honored to have the author of the best-selling series, Rizzoli and Isles, who I'm calling a Maine native, although I think she grew up in San Diego. You're here now. We have Tess Gerritsen here. Thank you so much for coming in, Tess.
Well, thank you. I know that 25 years as a Mainer doesn't really count, but it's close enough.
That's a big issue we've covered before. I don't know why Maine has that from away thing, because it feels like there's a negative thing as opposed to, boy, Tess Gerritsen moved here. We should be celebrating that.
That's right. It's a choice.
God, you've listened to my show. I did a whole show on the choice of people moving here in our economy, but I don't want to get too derailed there. Want to talk to you about a lot of things, but why don't we start with, if you wouldn't mind, because you're a best-selling author, and I want to cover your latest novel, which I have here, Die Again, which is now available everywhere. But I want to talk a little bit about how you grew up in San Diego, kind of your experience in terms of both education and becoming a doctor, studying medicine, and then how that led into you kind of career changing career paths. And I've listened and read other interviews where you've said, you know, that was your career path from age 7 and you just happened to return to it. But talk a little bit about growing up in California and then talk about how you ended up here in Maine, and we'll talk about your writing.
Yeah, well, I'm the daughter of Chinese, ethnic Chinese Americans. My father was born in the U.S. My mother was an immigrant. And if you have any contact with first generation immigrants, you know how important it's all about economic survival. It's all about security. So my dad wasn't pleased when I said I wanted to be a writer. He said, you know, there's no way to make a living in the arts. So he convinced me to go to medical school, and that's how I ended up going on this very long detour.
Well, I mean, some people would consider medicine and the skill and the study and the dedication as being in itself a peak of career accomplishment. But the other thing I want to talk about soon is, aside from growing up in San Diego, and then you worked for some period in Hawaii, the juxtaposition between San Diego, Hawaii, and here in Maine, especially with the weather we're having this weekend, I want to get to that, because some people would say, Tess Garrison, why aren't you someplace warm? But so what was it? So you graduated from Stanford.
Yep.
And with a BA in anthropology, studied medicine at University of California, two of my favorite places. My daughter now goes to school out in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the country.
It's beautiful. And by San Diego, I used to live in Laguna Beach. So that's the basis of my question. Also, in a few weeks, I'm going to be going to Maui with my family.
Oh, good for you.
So part of that, I want to get to your writing, but also, geez, why are you in this cold place? But we'll get there. So at what point after being a doctor, a successful internist, did you write a book, and then with the success of that, you decided to move away from medicine, or was it something where you just dedicated yourself to writing, and at what period did that happen?
Well, I had been writing all the way through childhood and through medical school because that was what I was, you know, just driven to do. But as I went into medicine, I went on a brief maternity leave, and I got the chance to actually write a full-length novel. And within a couple of years, I had sold that book to Harlequin Intrigue. It was sort of the romantic suspense line that they had. And I thought, yeah, maybe I could make a living at this. So for a while, I went half and half, medicine and writing, until we moved to Maine and I just decided to go full-time writing.
Well, you mentioned romantic and Harlequin. anyone who's followed your Do you refer to it as a series of books, the Rizzoli and Isle series?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
The two lead characters are the common element.
Right.
And for those of you that haven't either read the books, you should. You need to go out and buy all of Tess Garrison's books. But also watch the TV show with Angie Harmon and also Sasha Alexander. It's on TNT. So Jane Rizzoli is the detective,
yeah,
played by Angie, and Dr. Maura Iles is
medical examiner,
and so they are thrust together on these different cases, mm-hmm, where there's some combination of crime, whodunit, and where medicine kind of kicks in. So how did you transition from romance writing to medicine and crime? Because I understand the medicine part, but the crime part, is there something where you just had a...
It's a long transition, because I've written 25 books. I've been working for 30 years, and over time, ideas come to me that lead me down different paths. So I'd written about 9 romantic suspense novels when I got the idea for a medical suspense called Harvest. It was based on a conversation I had with a homicide cop who'd been traveling in Russia. He'd heard rumors that children were disappearing, were being kidnapped and shipped off to the Middle East as live organ donors. And I was so appalled by the idea that it could possibly be happening, I wrote a novel about it. It was my first big bestseller, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I should stop romance. Maybe I should just move into thrillers. So I did 4 medical thrillers. And then I got an idea for a crime novel, which was The Surgeon, and that launched the whole Rizzoli and Isles series. I never planned out my career. I just write the book that I want to write at that moment. And if it turns out to be a big success, I think, well, maybe I'll do another one.
You know, Deb, I think this is where this is where I have to come forward with the full disclosure.
I think you should.
I am a frustrated writer myself, a self-described hack. I write a weekly or biweekly column down here. I've always wanted to, and I have great admiration. I grew up with books, and it was really the only thing where I had an interest in. Clearly, academics wasn't it because it took 5 years for me to get through high school. But so, you know, I've met some successful authors, and so that's why having you come in here, it was like there's a combination of just great respect for what you've done and then just abject jealousy. It's like, boy, Tess Garrison, look at all the books. Talk a little bit about, you know, I want to talk about the process, the business of writing, being here in Maine, but let's start with that. From, I understand the evolution from being a doctor and being involved with writing, but how in the world did you end up going from California growing up, being a physician in Honolulu, to the furthest place or the juxtaposition, the greatest contrast between those places in the whole country and then coming to Maine?
You'd have to ask me on a winter day, wouldn't you?
This isn't a winter day. This is a winter 3 months. We are in a period of just apocalyptic snow.
You know, it's funny. We came to Maine one summer on vacation. It was in summertime, right? We went to Camden. It was beautiful. People were eating ice cream. The windjammers were out. And I thought, wow, I could live here. And so we moved to Maine in the dead of winter, that same winter.
Wow, this is you and your family?
Yes. I was sick of being on an island. I mean, we were in, yeah, okay. Oahu is beautiful. There's no doubt about it. Hawaii is a beautiful place. But after 12 years, I'd had enough. So we came here, and there were a couple things about Camden that drew me. Number one, they had a great library. And number two, they had three bookstores in a little tiny town. So we came here, and I found out that I was far more creative in the wintertime in Maine than I'd been anywhere else. So there's something about the combination of darkness, winter, the fact you can't do anything else. You have to stay in your house and keep your butt in your chair.
That's the secret sauce. You know, for all you aspiring writers out there, Tess Garrison, best-selling novelist, is giving you the secret. You need to be secluded someplace where there's atmospheric conditions that there's nothing else to do but sit in the chair and write.
And no distractions. So there's something about – and, you know, I've heard from the Chamber of Commerce that Maine has more writers per capita than any state in the country.
I've heard that too. I mean, obviously, you are world famous as a bestseller, Stephen King. And is James Patterson – there's a few others that live down here. You're familiar with other kind of novelists
There is a novelist named Elizabeth Hand who's very well known. She lives here, and we have a lot of summertime writers who are very famous and live here as well. So,
and there's my weekly column. So if you're ever asked again to list fame, I'm kidding. Don't even look at it. It's just such a puny little thing. By the way, we have Tess Garrison here. She is international best-selling author of many, many books, but probably most known currently because of the TV show, the Rizzoli and Isles series. I've heard, and I think I read in an earlier interview, that you prefer to write in longhand before committing to typing it, or is that still your style?
So
you feel the words,
style.
you literally, is it a pen, is it a pencil, but you sit there with a piece of paper and kind of construct the story so you see it as opposed to just digitize it?
It's not that entirely. What the problem with me when I do it digitally immediately as I see the words on the screen and I want to edit. I want to perfect it. And then I keep on perfecting that page and I never get beyond it. So my handwriting is just messy enough so that when I write on online typing paper, I can't really immediately read what I've written.
Okay. Again, the listening audience may not care about this point, but as somebody who wants to be a writer himself, you write on unlined paper.
Unlined
so even
paper.
That requires a discipline of thought, because otherwise, if I tried that, I'd end up with like 3 or 10 words and it would be crazy.
But that's okay, because that's where your creative aspect comes out. You're not trapped by lines. You're not trapped by anything but this blank piece of paper. And I think it helps me. I can write big. I can write small. And I find that depending on what part of the story I'm in, my handwriting, the size of my handwriting changes.
And this may be a silly question, but pen, pencil,
pen. I don't want to keep sharpening pencils.
I know, but I mean that's really old school, going like Hemingway with pencil or something like that. Okay, so you moved to Maine how many years ago?
I moved here in 1990.
And it was based on. I've always thought, Deb, that we have, you know, tourism is obviously such a big part of Maine's economy. But the secondary market is people like Tess who have come here on vacation and then later on, like the economy, the Tess Gerritsen economy, how do you measure that versus like summer tourism?
Yeah, the implants.
People who come, the people that, and, you know, I don't think as a state we do enough to either, you know, we have some great artistic outlets here. We have, film and photography, play, you know, there's writing worship.
We could do better marketing.
It's a great environment for creative arts and for people and musicians. We've got one of the greatest.
It's a creative state. It's wonderful. I mean, here I am living in Camden Rockport where we have so many artists. We have, you know, we have Maine Media Workshops.
We have
lots of photographers. But the really good thing that what happens beyond that is that artists paint Maine. Photographers take pictures of Maine. Our writers write about Maine, and that just sort of spreads the sense of what Maine is to the rest of the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, the Rizzoli and Isles series. I want to talk about the new book, and this just came out in the last month or so.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that's called Die Again. The series takes place in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about how it was set in Boston and not Maine.
Yeah.
Because we just talked about, and I've read a few of your books, but do any of them take place in Maine, or have you yourself used Maine as a backdrop for either the character development or the books themselves? And then I want to talk a little bit about these characters and then talk a little bit about your the business of being a world-famous novelist?
Well, I use Maine in several of my books. I've used it in a book called Bloodstream, and then my characters sometimes come to Maine. The reason I chose Boston, when I was writing my very first serial killer book called The Surgeon, was it wasn't really believable that we would have a huge homicide unit in Maine, because we're one of the safest states in the country. To believe that we would have like a problem with serial killers it started to feel like Jessica Fletcher, like Murder, She Wrote. And this is a funny thing I heard from one of our state detectives. He said, you know, Maine, we have had three serial killers here, but they always come from away. So that was why I chose Boston. It was the largest close city to us.
And did you have experience in Boston, or like everything else, did you have to go down there and research it for context and for the nuance and spend some time maybe with the Boston Police Department or something?
Yeah,
like that?
I have been down to Boston PD. I know some homicide detectives. And my husband and I once spent a whole day driving around Boston looking for appropriate places to dump bodies.
Wow.
That's how far we go with our research.
And again, for all the reviews of your books, a common theme is your attention to detail. And that's, obviously if you spend a day looking at places to dump bodies and then you have to learn about firearms and you have to learn about police procedure and a little bit of the legal process.
Yeah, that's not to say I don't get stuff wrong all the time, and I hear about it. My readers will tell me if I've made a mistake. And I know that writers in general, the mistakes we make tend to be about firearms. And the letters we get tend to be from firearm owners. So you'll see that a lot of writers no longer are specific. We'll just say weapon so we don't get into trouble.
Wow. We have Tess Gerritsen here. She is a best-selling author. We talked a little bit about the mechanical process of your writing on unlined paper with pen. And I'm taking notes because I'm trying to emulate your success. And I will start writing with unlined paper with pen. But it looks like you average about a book a year. So you are so successful, and you've had how many now? 25. 25 books. And you have to keep each story fresh, and you have to keep each kind of story arc. You know, generally, especially with the crime, with the medical crime drama, you kind of have – there's a problem, and you kind of make sure that at the end there's a payoff where who did it? You can't just leave the book like something bad happened. So that's a little bit of the story arc. But how do you approach when you start the next book? Like right now, this has been published, so you're probably in the cycle for your next book.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a bunch of these blank pieces of paper. You have your pen. Are you disciplined to the point where every day at a certain time you go to a particular room in your house? And are you, do you subscribe to the writer's kind of discipline of 4 hours a day or 5,000 words? Or what's your approach? Because you clearly have a great creative formula. But how do you approach it from the actual writing?
It's really not that organized. The first thing I always tell writers is that the process is whatever works for you, works for you, and there's no right or wrong way to do it.
Well, I've been doing it the wrong way, so it's great that you're being so nice, but clearly I haven't published anything of crazy little columns. And you are all over the world. You've been translated in dozens of languages. It's published all over the world. So, but there is a wrong way. You've been doing it the right way. I've been doing it the wrong way.
Well, here's my secret for, you know, it's always, what's the old saying? The journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Okay.
Right.
It starts with a single paragraph. That's where it all begins. And the only way I can move forward in a story is know exactly what the emotions are of my characters at the time. I don't plot my stuff out ahead of time. I don't do outlines. I know the opening scene and I know the sort of like the general outline of what the mystery is about. Let me give you an example of how we started Die Again. The idea for that came while I was on safari in Africa. We had this wonderful bush guide who, when he met us in the bush, he said, "Stay in the jeep, do what I say, and I will keep you safe." So one afternoon, we stopped for cocktails. We were all out of the jeep drinking our gin and tonic. And my husband said, "You know, I really have to pee. I'm going to go in that bush over there." And my guide said, "No, why don't you go in the other direction?" So my husband goes off in the other direction. And out of the first bush that he was originally headed for, out walked a leopard. We're all out of the jeep. The leopard starts toward us. And our bush guide just moved between us and the leopard. And he pretty much saved our lives by staring at this cat. And the cat went back into the bushes.
Well, did he stare at a cat with a gun or did he just stare at
the
cat?
Well, there was a gun in the jeep, but he didn't pick up the gun. He realized that he had the mojo to get this cat, you know, to turn this cat away. So he saved our lives. He certainly saved my husband's life. And I thought later, wow, you have to trust your guide, because in this area where everything wants to kill you or eat you, you trust the person who is supposed to keep you safe. And then I thought, oh, but what if you trusted the wrong person? What if the guy who picked you up at the bush landing strip is not the man who was supposed to meet you, but an imposter who's there to pick up his next truckload of victims? So then I went home and thought, okay, most dangerous creature in the bush is on two legs, and that got the whole, you know, it got the juices going. So I start off with the same situation. Tourists fly into, you know, the bush and are never seen again. What happened? And that was the impetus for how the story started. But it all starts off with an idea that freaks me out or scares me or bothers me so much I have to write a book about it.
That is so fascinating. That was a great story. But from your experience as in medicine, as a doctor, and specifically to the Rosolian Isles series and in your basis of the two characters, do you use the Dr. Moore Isles character, who's played by Sasha Alexander, as an anchor point because more of your experience is from medicine? Or have you gotten to the point now where you're equally comfortable writing the procedural criminal side? Or is Moore Isles more anchored from your personal experience and maybe even you personally?
Well, I feel most comfortable writing Morris scenes because, as you said, that's my background is medicine. But the police procedural stuff, I'm always a little shaky on. I'm always wondering, would a cop actually do this? I think that she is certainly a personal anchor for me because she really reflects a lot of who I am, you know, my background, my likes, even my biographical data. People don't realize it, but Maura went to Stanford and she graduated from UC San Francisco as well.
What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. And she drives the same kind of car I do. So it's, you know, that's why she feels comfortable when I write her.
Yeah. Wow. Talk a little bit about with 25 novels, three bestsellers, 30 million copies sold, 40 languages. And as you've mentioned in the past, many of your novels have been either optioned or sold for movies or TV rights.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the business, the literary business, which you've clearly have succeeded in. There's the television film business, which you've had success selling. But the TNT show, looks like you also wrote the screenplay Adrift, which was a movie of the week back mm-hmm. in the 90s with Kate Jackson. But do you find that now that the TV show is going on its fifth or sixth?
It will be going into its sixth season.
Going into
year.
Its sixth season. Are you involved at all with any of the screenwriting?
I
know that you've sold the licensing, but so there's screenwriters that write the series based on the characters, and they've optioned. But do you find it all that you're watching or you're reading the scripts from the series and that is in some way moving you as the writer of the novels into different directions? Because they're creating characters that in some ways are a little different. The characters on TV, I think, feel a little more humorous or playful. And is the dog wagging, is the tail wagging the dog at any place where you're watching the series and the two actresses are so dynamic that you sit down to the next book and almost have to conform the book series a little bit to the TV, or are they completely separate areas?
I try to keep them completely separate. I want to write my characters the way I created them, which is, you know, granted, I'm not a very funny person, and the television writers are really, really funny, and I think that adds a lot to the TV show. But there are a lot of my readers who will never watch the television show, and they're going to be a little jarred if my character suddenly turn into, you know, Sasha and Angie. Now, the truth is, though, when I write Jane Rosoli's scenes now, I'm starting to hear Angie Harmon's voice. I can't help that.
She's got literally and figuratively such a distinctive voice as an actress.
She has a great voice. Yeah.
She has a great voice, but she has an approach to the character that's just it's dynamic in a way that she's kind of made it her own.
She was a perfect cast choice for Jane Rosoli, even though she's way too beautiful for the part. I mean, my Jane in the books is an ordinary-looking woman, and all of a sudden she's gorgeous on television.
I know, and Angie does that with kind of this unassuming kind of like, you know, and you see that with a lot of Hollywood actresses. Oh, I'm not anything special. And it's like, really, you're Angie Harmon. Of course you're.
Put them in front of a camera, and they are extraordinary, yeah.
That's so funny. So how much involvement do you have as the writer of the books? Are you involved at all? Do you consult with the executive producers? Do you ever go to the shooting? I mean, you must go to some of the premiere stuff because your characters are so integral. But is it a completely separate business process once that you sell the rights to the characters in the books? And or do you have any creative input at this point?
You know, they have been great. They have invited me again and again to join them in the writer's room, and I haven't because I'm writing books. I've been to the set a couple of times, enough to know that it is a grueling process to film a television series, and I don't think I would have the energy to do it. So, no, they have their own team of writers, which keeps changing every year. But what you know, the first year when I met the executive producer, her name was Janet Tamaro, and she was the showrunner. She was the one who wrote the original script, and I got a chance to hear her version of what she felt she was writing, and she said something to me. She said, "You know, you're two women. I know who you're really writing about when you write about Jane and Maura. You are writing about Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock," which hadn't even occurred to me. But after she said it, I thought, well, you know, she got right to the heart of the matter of what these two characters, how they're different.
Spock was more analytical.
Right, scientific and logical.
Kirk was more emotive and more go with his gut instinct.
And that's the cop. So when she put it that way, I thought that's the template they're using. And that is the template they started off with, Kirk and Spock, but female.
Right. I mean, speaking of the female thing, there's lots of online conversation and speculation on the relationship of Jane and Maura mm-hmm. in the series. Mm-hmm. And I think the TV show takes a kind of a playful approach.
Yeah.
And maybe more so than in your writing. But what is their relationship aside from being a great detective and a great medical exam? There's a playfulness that I think seems like it's deliberate.
Uh-huh.
And so it's written that way and the scenes are shot that way. But do they have a personal relationship, a close friendship? Do you think the TV show is moving in a direction that's so different from what you're writing that it's just more it's fiction on fiction or
fiction on fiction sounds rather
yeah.
a little spicy there.
But yeah, well, with 50 Shades coming out this weekend. We got to be careful with any kind of reference.
Yeah,
but yes, that wasn't the intent. But but it does feel like, you know, when as I having you come in, I researched and went online and just saw what was the current state of the state with people talking about this great series and great book series. And a lot of the conversation has to do with their great chemistry as actresses and characters.
Is there sexual something going
on? Is there something going on? And I know that you've been asked that 1,000 times,
yep.
And so I don't expect you to come to Falmouth, Maine today and say, okay, Steve, let me tell you the truth. But if you wanted to do that, that
well,
would...
okay. Well, here's the truth. And, you know, I had no idea it would be taken that way. When I wrote the books, they were uneasy friends, partners, you know, they respect each other, they're professional women.
National tension between I'm doing my job. You're,
right.
Sometimes there's conflict with one job versus the other.
And they're different. They're so different in terms of personality that there was bound to be conflict between them. So that was where the books come from. On TV, they chose two really beautiful actresses. They started off with the friendship being very, very strong. And they started off the very first was the pilot episode. They had a sleepover in the same bed. So I think that got –
Do you think – have you ever as a medical – as a doctor – I don't really see detectives and medical examiners just naturally ending up like, wow, that was a tough case.
Yeah, well, that was – I mean, well, I think it was put in there because they wanted to play up the friendship. But I think what the producers didn't realize is how that would awaken the imagination of so many viewers who within a couple of episodes said they're gay. They're
right.
Obviously gay. And when the network realized that there was this whole swell of you know, excitement out there in the audience about the possibility that Jane and Maura were lesbian, they may have decided they were going to be playful about it and do a little bit more on the show. So I think it kind of fed on each other. It is a surprise to me. I think it was definitely a surprise to the original writers who didn't think that was going to happen. But in the meantime, we're all just happy that people are seeing what they want to see in the stories.
Yeah, and I think it's less about being straight or gay than two people that are really comfortable with each other. And
yeah.
It's less about the label, but it's just kind of this playful thing. But TV is a visual medium, and again, the two lead actresses are just very attractive, very
right.
sharp. Powerful women characters.
Yep.
So if they want to have a sleepover after a tough case, why not?
Go ahead and
have
you
a
know,
glass of wine and just kind of just relax.
And honestly, when I look at them, I think if I were gay, yeah, they'd be pretty good choices, wouldn't they?
Again, yes. We on WLOB 1310 AM. We don't cover that subject quite a bit, do we, Deb, on the morning show?
Not normally,
but you know what? It's.
But why not?
Why not?
Confessions. They have private confessions.
Absolutely. We have best-selling author Tess Gerritsen here, and she is the author of the series Rizzoli and Isles, as well as many other books. Talk a little bit about – we're jumping all over the place here. Who are some authors that were – I guess every author is asked this, just like every musician is asked, who are your inspirations? But who in a specific genre of authors where they had their work turned into either film or television? A couple of mine, Leonard Elmore, I don't know if you've watched the show Justified. Do you ever
– I haven't watched that show, no.
Okay. Great writer, but his show Justified, this is his final season. Very well, in my opinion, very well written. But compared to other series, Dick Wolf, what he's done with Law and Order, and I think it's now it's Law and Order and SVU, and there's like 10 different. Did you know the voice of Law and Order, the guy who does the opening voice thing, is a Mainer?
I didn't know that.
So, the guy is like in the criminal justice system.
Oh, wow.
He may be your neighbor in Camden. I think he lives up there. But who are writers or what shows do you look at and think that's particularly well written? Because the idea of writing in words, I have found in my limited experience, we've lost some appreciation with digital technology. Mm-hmm. And for people like yourself that are just great writers and just, you really understand language, it's becoming more and more rare. And you see it in film and in TV and certainly in books. But who are some authors who their work has you think has translated into either interesting or good television or films that you have an appreciation for?
Well, I can just say that I am completely addicted to Game of Thrones. I think the writing on that, the production values on that have been amazing.
Have you seen that, Deb?
No.
Oh, come on. Then you're not even in this conversation. If you haven't seen Game of Thrones, it is the best thing on television.
Yeah. But television writing has gotten so good since we've expanded beyond networks. Now we're into cable. And so you're getting Vince Gilligan with Breaking Bad, which was one of
Saul, and then moving on to his new one.
Yes, right. Just Call Saul. That's another – it sounds like it's going to be – I mean, I watched the first episode. It's going to be
great.
But
Game of Thrones is like three different shows because there's different sets. Like one set of characters are going over the wall.
Yes.
One set of characters has dragons. One set of characters are chopping people's heads. But it's so well written.
The adaptation must have been a bear. I mean, I just can't imagine the challenge of that. So you have that, and then you have so many like Homeland. TV shows that could not have made it in the old days on network television where everything was blended down to the lowest common denominator. Now we're getting really edgy stuff. So I think that the real art in film is going to be on cable TV now.
What about Hunger Games, the author of Hunger Games?
Yeah, I think that ended up being a really good translation. I haven't seen the last one, but I was there right away to see the first couple, and I thought they, again – really, really good. So, Gone Girl. I thought Gone Girl was a very, very good film adaptation. I loved the book, and I thought the movie was just as good.
Talk a little bit about of all the books that you have. Which do you ever write thinking about how it would translate into a movie or series, or are you just focused on the literary kind of structure of making a compelling story, and if somebody buys the movie, great, or options the series. And then I want to talk a little bit about Gravity.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. I'm going to talk about Gravity because that
Perfect.
Is one of the things where, not every book as you're writing it is visual. I mean, for instance, a lot of these crime novels are not entirely visual, but Gravity is probably the one where I was writing, I could see it, and I lived it, in my dreams. And by the time I finished writing that book 2 years later, I was dreaming I was weightless every night. And that's how much the science and the atmosphere of being in microgravity gets into your soul. So, that particular book I knew was visual. And there was another book I wrote called The Bone Garden, which was set in 1830. In Boston and during an epidemic of child bed fever. It was another book which was very, very visual. So it depends on the story.
Let's talk about the business of the business. You mentioned Gravity being mm-hmm. visual because it wasn't just theater of the mind. You wrote the detail. There's also some legal issues relative to Gravity. And you may or may not be able to talk about certain things that are ongoing. But if you could give the quick top. So you wrote the book. Uh-huh. There was an option for the book.
Actually, it was an outright sale.
An outright sale. So once you sell, they own it.
They
and then
own
one
it.
Film company bought another film company. And then somewhere down the line, what they bought, another movie was produced, which people recognize as the George Clooney, Sandra Bullock movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's some, discrepancy in terms of your view that the book that you sold – was at least the basis or the concept for part of the movie. And their view was, no, separate. I don't want you to go in any area you're not comfortable with, but is part of the – Hollywood's a dirty place.
Yeah, well, I'm discovering that.
I know. Here you are, this doctor, this writer. You live in Camden, Maine. You go to and then Hollywood. And even the way they handle movies and they calculate profits and people have points and they take off marketing. Everything you hear about that place is it is a jungle, and it feels like your experience with Gravity has been a little bit
– Well, it's tough because my experience on Rizzoli & Isles has been great. I mean, I thought – I loved Warner TV, and they've been very kind to me. This has been a shock to me, actually. I sold – going back, in case your audience hasn't heard, I wrote a book called Gravity in 1999 and sold it to New Line Productions. The book is about it's a long book. It's a very detailed plot. But basically, it's about a female medical doctor, mission specialist, astronaut, who is sent to the International Space Station. And there, a series of accidents occur that involve a biohazard. Her crew is killed through a series of accidents. She is stranded alone aboard aboard the space station. This is the International Space Station, not a fictional space station.
Right.
So we're talking about a real place. In the course of – after having sold it to New Line, they were not entirely pleased with the script that came in from their screenwriter because the third act sort of fell flat. It was a medical, you know, it was a medical ending, and I said, "Let me fix the third part." And I, in my third act, they shot down a satellite to avoid a collision with ISS. It released a bunch of debris. It brings down ISS, and my female astronaut is left floating in space in her spacesuit with, you know, untethered by herself.
That sounds like Sandy Bullock.
It sounds kind of similar.
Again, I know you don't want to say too much, but that sounds exactly like the movie I saw last year.
You know, if you go back into the book, you see, yes, she's forced to do a spacewalk to repair some damage. There's a panic return to the airlock where she's waiting for it to repressurize. There are a lot of specific visual things that are in the book that ended up in the movie, but. So 8-9 years later, Cuarón wrote his original script called Gravity. It went, you know, became a film by Warner Brothers, which since 2008 has owned New Line Productions. So I saw the similarities, but I wasn't going to make any accusations because I didn't know that he had anything to do with my story.
Right.
Until February of last year when we were informed that he was attached to direct my movie when my book was first picked up.
So if that was the case, clearly he had access to your movie in the back.
It would have given him access certainly to the whole package. It'd be hard to argue
that it was like two inventions happening on opposite sides of the world and it's just a coincidence.
With so many coincidences plus the title, the identical title, and, you know, and some of the things that were so identical, like specifically this woman and International Space Station, where there were no other movies set on ISS, no other books set on ISS. So it's not a common place to put it because of all the research that's involved. So that's how we finally decided to file suit. And, you know, we're going through this long, long process.
Isn't that the worst lawsuits? Because especially, I mean, you just want to wake up in the morning and be creative and do good things. And then waking up with lawyers and depositions and all. I hate that.
Well, what I really hate is the fact that this is a scorched earth thing that they're doing. Okay, I mean the letters they're saying, the things they're saying about me, the stuff that goes into the press releases, which are entirely false. You know, my lawyer just says, I don't care what the public thinks. I just want to win the case. So just be patient, and we'll see what happens.
Again, in terms of the Gravity, best of luck with that. It's a tough process to go through, but. We'll be watching that.
Yeah, my first ever lawsuit, and it had to end up on the front page.
I know, but is it the culture of Hollywood? Is it the that side of the business? You've had a great experience with the TV production. It's on TNT, but it's produced by
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers by coincidence.
Yeah,
but a different division, probably. Yeah, you know? But. Yeah, it's the business of – you hear stories like that all the time.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of stories, especially because screenwriters are writing to me now. I've sort of become the symbol of fighting back. And, you know, the stories they tell, it's amazing because copyright infringement, to try and win a copyright infringement case is almost impossible. You need it's practically identical elements between two projects. Luckily, mine is a breach of contract case, which is very, very different. And you just need to be inspired by an earlier project to win that case.
I think you were quoted as saying every writer who sells to Hollywood should be alarmed. Is it based on this experience?
Yes, it's based on this experience because the objection that Warner Brothers has to my lawsuit, they haven't really addressed the similarity issue. What they're saying is, yeah, we may own New Line Productions, but we are not really bound to honor the contract that Tess signed with New Line. So what it means is it leaves me completely without remedy because I can't sue for copyright infringement. New Line Productions owns the copyright. And Warner Brothers owns New Line.
Wow. Yeah, it feels like they do that double reverse thing a lot so out in Hollywood. So in the next few minutes, you gave an interview, I'm not sure if it was in the last year or two, where you were talking about your creative process and kind of the catalyst for some of these characters. And you mentioned that part of what you thought was the basis is you felt a little bit as an outsider yourself, much like Jane, the character.
Yes, yeah.
Is that from your early experience as Asian American, Chinese American in the country? Was it a cultural thing that made you feel, and did that allow you? So the negative feeling of feeling like an outsider certainly wasn't a comfortable feeling, but did it allow you to be more dedicated and precise to the things that were of interest to you, that isolation?
I think it comes from being an Asian American. When I was growing up in San Diego, we were living in a very conservative part of town. It was close to U.S. Navy housing. So I experienced, all the epithets that they would call, people who were not white. And I remember my father responding. He said, "The only way to fight back is to be better than them, is to work harder, achieve more, and be more successful." And I think that that's what Asian parents say to all their little kids: work harder, be more successful. And that is the only way to rise in this society. So I've always felt that. It's always been a really strong sense of not really belonging anywhere, particularly in Maine. Maine is a very, very white state, and I stand out. On the other hand, it also feels strangely comfortable to me.
Yeah, that's why it's just unusual, and I can't speak for 1.3 million Mainers, but I should. It's great having you here, but it seems like an unusual choice a quarter of a century ago because Maine is very homogenous.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Coming from a kind of a foundation of growing up in an area where you felt, I don't know if disenfranchised is the right word, but at least not as embraced in community, to come to Maine is really interesting.
Well, I remember I had this experience as we were coming across the Maine Turnpike for the very first time, and we came across somebody who was, collecting the toll. And I heard her talk, and she had a very strong Maine accent, and there was something familiar about it, very weirdly familiar about it. And I turned to my husband and said, "I think I may have lived here in a past life." Maybe that was what it did. Maybe that was why I ended up here and why I continue to be here.
Interesting. And since you opened the door, Tess Gerritsen, do you believe in past life?
No, I don't. But it was
just a familiarity thing where it was something that interesting.
Yeah, it was a comfort that I continue to feel while I live here.
By the way, you're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We're also on WLOBradio.com. We have Tess Gerritsen, who is a best-selling author, many, many books. New book out is Die Again. This is part of the Rizzoli and Isles series of books where the two main characters, Jane Rizzoli, who is on television, a TNT show, is played by Angie Harmon, and Dr. Maura Isles. If you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about this new book, which, by the way, is available everywhere. I have my copy here. I think I can speak for Tess when she says that she really loves local bookstores. So if you're close to a local bookstore, go in there. But if you're not, then it's available on Amazon and everywhere in the whole world. But talk a little bit about Die Again in this book and where this latest in the series kind of takes your characters.
It's number 11 in the Rizzoli and Isles series, and Jane and Maura confront the death of a big game hunter who's been found hanging in his garage, gutted as if he's a large animal. They follow the clues and realize that it has something to do with the disappearance of seven tourists in Africa 6 years before, and that's where that safari nightmare starts to weave into the story. So it's a story about large cats, about hunting, and about the most dangerous creature on earth is actually on two legs.
I know. Every time that people talk about danger in the outdoors, that whole dynamic of man is the most dangerous, man and man's behavior is the most dangerous. How far, as a writer, with Rizzoli and Isles being such a commercial and successful series, what's the impetus for either continuing or taking a break and starting a different either series or go to books that have nothing to do with these characters?
It's a great question.
It based on demand from the audience? Because the audience love these books. They're bestsellers. And so your publisher is probably, "Oh, come on, Tess, let's do another Rizzoli and Isles." And you may wake up going, "You know what? I love the characters, but I may want to do a different setting, a different genre." And how do you kind of balance the commercial side of being a very commercial, successful writer with being an artist as a writer?
Sometimes you just have to push. And in fact, the book I'm just finishing right now, it'll be probably turned in the next week, has nothing to do with Rizzoli and Isles. It's a book about the Italian Holocaust. It starts off with a woman violinist who picks up this this piece of music, a music manuscript in Rome, and she takes it home, and every time she plays it, her three-year-old daughter goes berserk and does something violent. And so she thinks, wow, this music is haunted. What's the story behind this music that's handwritten and nobody knows anything about it? And you'll see in parallel story where it comes from. You'll see the young composer who was a Jew in Venice and what happens to him and how this music ties into the present day. It's about the power of music to haunt us after 70 years.
Did you go to Rome to research it? Did you spend any time, or was it all just...
It came to me while I had a nightmare in Venice.
You were in Venice.
I was in Venice, and I had a nightmare, and I woke up, and the whole story was there. But the really fun part
So wherever you go, like you go big game hunting, you go on safari...
I pay attention to what scares me.
And all of a sudden, die again happens. You go to Venice. Is there any chance that a year or 2 years from now, you're writing a Tide Smart Steve-O kind of story... Not that it would be a nightmare, but maybe it'll be a good catalyst where, because if you take inspiration from experience, maybe, you know, today.
Every experience is grist for the mill. You know, and I always tell when kids say, what should I study to become a writer? I tell them, you know, live a life, fall in love, have a child, get a job.
Live different places, go to Hawaii, be a doctor.
Travel is really, I think, really important to, for writers as well. It's a very, very, you know, good creative punch in the gut that gets you going.
I think it's good for everyone. I wish more politicians travel because we get so myopic and we get so limited in our view, whether it's in Maine or here in the U.S., we just have this thing where, we must be right because it's the way we've always done it. And then you travel around Europe and, you know, I've been to 40 different countries and I always pick up something somewhere else, whether it's an approach, a cultural thing, a technology thing. I was in Barcelona not long ago. And something as silly as how they handle their trash. Like you go to New York and trash and garbage is piled up and nobody in New York talks about it as being anything. It's like, oh, yeah, trash is packed. You go to Barcelona and they have these giant color-coded bins on every street corner for paper, for plastic, for glass and reusable. And everyone in the city automatically put stuff in the – and then these vehicles come and pick up the glass, pick up the – and it's like, that's smart. But but you go to different places and you see that stuff.
And if you don't go to those places, your mind will never be open. I'm just riding, you know, the train, you know, the super super fast train in France. It's got to awaken Americans to the possibilities here. But you know, most Americans don't travel.
Absolutely. Well, in the coming minute, boy, we need to have you back. Like, if it wouldn't be too much to ask, every week would be nice, Tess. By the way, we have Tess Gerritsen here. You mentioned the book that you're just finishing up. Is it titled yet? Is it released yet?
Yeah, it's called Playing with Fire. And here's the cool part. I've told you about it's a haunted piece of music. I've composed the music. So I'm going to try and get somebody who could a good enough violinist who will record it. And if you buy the book, you can hear this waltz online.
Wow. And what's the publishing timeline for that?
I'm not sure. We haven't. I haven't heard a schedule for it yet.
Well, we will be standing by. Thank you so much for coming down from Camden, and thank you for being in Maine, and thank you for making amateur writers like me jealous and envious of your talent. And it was just such a pleasure meeting you today.
Thank you. And if you really want to write, keep writing.
I will. Thank you very much. That's Tess Gerritsen. She is best-selling author, and also she has a website for more information, Tess, T-E-S-S, Gerritsen, Gerritsen.com. Also, as I recently found out, she is active on social media in Twitter, at Tess Gerritsen. She is very interactive with fans and very generous with her time and advice to aspiring writers like myself. Please buy her latest book, Die Again. It's a great book. And you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. News Talk WLB, 1310 AM. We'll be back.